Hi, and on today's episode of How Not to Think, I'm delighted to have on our show, all the way from New Mexico, Brenda Wolf. Brenda is a clinical psychologist who has specialized for many years in the treatment of eating disorders and obesity, as well as offering psychotherapy for anxiety and mood disorders. She's a very accomplished lady. She's done a lot of work, particularly in her home state of New Mexico recently, serves as volunteer faculty at the University of New Mexico Department of Psychiatry, newsletter editor for the New Mexico Psychological Association, and she served on numerous professional committees, including the Academy of Eating Disorders, and so on and so forth. She currently works at the SAGE Neuroscience Center. She's been there for a couple of years. And perhaps more importantly, she is the author of a great book, which is called A Diet is the Last Thing You Need. Brenda, welcome. Great to see you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So the first question I always ask my guests is just a little bit of a career trajectory of how you get to be doing what you're doing today.
Okay. So I was an angst-ridden teenager. I know, very rare animal that was. Angst-ridden teenager, got to college, thought, I'll take some psych classes. Maybe I'll be able to understand myself better. Wow. My angst became so unexciting when I got into those classes because, man, oh, man, psych is interesting. It is engaging. It was mind-blowing for me. So the origin story is I'm a psych addict, bit of a junkie here. Totally forgot about my angst and totally got into the field. So that was sort of undergraduate, graduate work, everything I've done. I've been in this business for over 40 years. I don't think I've been bored a minute in all that time, except for a couple of continuing ed classes that I won't name names on. But in terms of getting into the field of obesity and eating disorders, when I was as an undergraduate at McGill, I was actually very interested in what now is called neuropsychology. At the time, it was called physiological psychology. And for my honors research, I got involved in a lab that was doing absolutely like cooler than cool brain research. We were implanting electrodes in rat brains and looking at reinforcement schedules and, you know, reward areas of the brain. Super, super interesting, except for one small problem. I'm not an animal person. So at the end of my first solid year in this professor's lab, I realized I am still like, they found me the thickest lab coat in all of McGill University, so I would feel less exposed to the rats I was handling. But I just never got to where I could do it calmly and enjoy the material. You know, so I said I better find another project quick because I still needed to do honors research. There was a fellow in the department named Ernest Poser, who was doing very, very interesting at the time, cutting edge work in cognitive behavioral interventions for obesity. He took me on as his student. I worked out at the Douglas Psychiatric Hospital in Verdun, Quebec, doing obesity trials. And that's how I got in on that end. Over the years, then that interest has expanded to include eating disorders. And I want to make the point right at the get-go here. Obesity, overeating is not an eating disorder. They overlap. Eating disorders feed into obesity. Obesity and the efforts to control it feed into eating disorders, but they're not the same thing. Additionally, while I'm on my soapbox, obesity is not a mental disorder. It is a medical disorder that has psychological components, which is the stuff that I deal with. So I got into that. That expanded. Career-wise, I know I'm long-winded. You can cut me off at any time, Howard. I did graduate work in that area. And then I worked for several years. I was actually head of research and development for Jenny Craig Weight Loss Centers, which is, that was the period during which you and I initially met. Mm-hmm. From there, I went on, did other stuff, re-specialized. And then the last 20 plus years here in New Mexico, I'm now actually sort of retired. I think I told you I failed retirement. Which good, I can I'm answer glad. Questions about in a minute. But I started my own clinic called Eating Disorders Institute of New Mexico, here actually in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, which is a small city on the outskirts of Albuquerque, where I live. And for 20 some years, treated patients with eating disorders and obesity and ran programs and had a ball, thought I was ready to retire. Wasn't quite ready. And so now I work part-time, as you said, at Sage Neuroscience Center.
Hey,
that's my story.
Yes. And so a very extensive background in the subject of eating disorders and obesity. And of course, your book is really helpful. I think it's a great book that...
Thank you.
Really gets to the heart of some of the real problems and the misconceptions people have about that area. And I like the tired diet title, the diet, a diet is the last thing you need. Tell us about the book.
Well, the book is, as you said, the title, Diet is the Last Thing You Need. One of the things that is apparent from the size of the weight loss industry. I mean, I don't hold numbers in my head very well, but it's like several billion a year, or billion or 1.9, something like that, that is spent. And I think that's just in the United States, never mind the rest of the planet. It's this huge industry for weight loss. And yet we keep getting heavier and heavier. I mean, there are diet foods and diet pills and diet. There was another one I saw advertised this morning, another pill that will make you lose weight magically somehow.
Yeah.
We can certainly talk about that later if you like. But what I wanted to do with the book, again, based on my experience, I'm a little going in three directions at once. There are so many weight loss products and they promise awesome stuff. And I always say to patients, if you just spend enough money on the pills I'm making or the programs I'm running, you will lose weight. It's just about spending enough money. Well, the fact of the matter is clear to everyone. You can spend fortunes, but we're still getting heavier and people lose weight on all these wild ass diets, and then they gain it back. And so when I work with patients, we spend an awful lot of time doing a recalibration of expectation about what is possible in the way of weight loss, given one's genetic and lifestyle context, expectation about what sort of effort is involved, expectation about how to go about it, and so on and so forth. And what happened was when I tried to retire in 2018, my valiant effort at retirement, I started thinking about all the work I had done, all the knowledge I have worked very hard to attain, knowledge and experience. And I thought, I want to capture that. I want to put that into a book. Because I was, just a side note, at the same time, my mother died that year or the year before. I mean, there were just all these endings in my life, not the least of which was my retirement, which didn't stick. But it was sort of like, what happens to all this knowledge, right? When my mother died, what happened? All her stories, where'd they go? The songs she sang, where'd they go? So it was like, okay, so it's a little bit of a narcissistic venture on my part. I wanted to capture this. And so what I've done with the book, and you I know you read it, so it's structured in a question and answer format. I answer the questions that have come up over the last bazillion years in therapy. So why do I act like this? How do I do that? What does this mean? And so it's set up in that sort of we start with what I call the foundation, which is what are the realistic expectations? You know, if you come from a long line of super skinny people and you earn your living digging ditches and carrying rocks, you would have to devote a lot of work energy to gaining weight, to right. becoming overweight. Conversely, if you come from a long line of gigantic people and you've been overweight or obese your whole life and you earn your living sitting on your tush at a desk, you might not end up being able to look like Twiggy. Right. And I don't know if your listeners are old enough to know who she was, but she was an exceedingly thin model back in the day.
Yes.
So we start there.
Right.
Pardon?
My sister went to school with Twiggy. Twiggy was from our area in North London.
She was the bane of my adolescent existence because Twiggy had no hips. All the jeans that they were selling in the one cool jean shop in Montreal, right. where I'm from, the shop was called Donovan's, cool shop name too. Mm. None of those jeans had room for female hips. Any hips. Yeah. It was like, oh man, I hated Twiggy.
You know, on the subject of the marketing and the selling of programs, I mean, I do have a program where as soon as you sign up, you lose 50 pounds because it costs $80 and that's about 50 British pounds. So
that's right. Exactly.
But let's just talk about that because I'm sure it is so aggravating to you. It certainly is to me. When you see the marketing and advertising for products that we both know have no scientific background or evidence, and for the most part are simply a waste of money. Doesn't that aggravate the hell out of you?
Makes me a little crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, and I want to actually address, because I as I said, excuse me, initially, I did work for Jenny Craig Weight Loss Centers. Mm-hmm. I did, hold on, I'm going to just pause for a second and cough a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. It's allergy season here in New Mexico, right. which is basically, but here it's like every all year except November, December, and January.
Oh, wow.
At least for me. And anyway, so when I was with Jenny in the late 80s, early 90s, I was there for about 4.5, almost 5 years. And that was during her like meteoric rise in the US. And we had centers in Australia, which is where she started, in North America, in South America, in Europe. I think that was it. Anyhow. A lot of continents. And when I joined them, what I was able to do was two things of which I'm quite proud, because I always walk that line between, can I use foul language? I'll use just a little bit foul language. I walk that line between stupid ass programs and mm-hmm. what I know is good science. So the two things I was able to do was change their, if you remember when the metropolitan weight height tables were before BMI was, back when BMI was the Quetelet's index, before it was the thing. And we used the metro tables and I had them go from the 59 to the, was it 83? And we upped it. So we were not taking money from people who clearly were underweight.
Right.
But the other bigger thing that I was able to do there was develop the materials that went out to clients that talked about behavior change and, you know, mindset change. And so what my job was to bring psychology into it. So that's my kind of,
your claim to fame.
Not even so much a claim to fame as that was my sort of atonement for working for a commercial program. You know, and I am not bad mouthing them. I had a great time at that company. I, you know, traveled and taught, you know, educated people and anyhow was, and I think did good work. But it's always a little bit of a balancing act. So back to your question about when I see ridiculous ads, makes me a little crazy. makes me sad that they're making way more money than the sensible ads are making. I get angry. I write blogs about it. I do have a blog where I complain about that at times. And I do my best to educate my patients and my family and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So back to the book again. Mm-hmm. A diet is the last thing you need. Tell us a little bit more about that theory and what you go into.
Okay. So we start with, as I said earlier, the foundation, which is sort of what are the realistic expectations? One of the things I walk the reader through, which is something I do typically with my patients as well, is, as I alluded to before, we have like a little exercise of how do you determine what's a realistic weight target for you? And we start with, let's not have a weight target. You know, if your goal is to weigh 162 pounds, good luck with that, because you're going to hit that if you hit that goal. The next day, you're going to have a really big poop in the morning and you're going to be 161 and a half. Right. And then you're going to go out and have my favorite dinner, blackened salmon with blackened anything vegetable. And you're going to be retaining water. And then you're going to be 163 and a half the next day. So what is the purpose therein? So I talk about, you know, let's get a range, and we base that range, and we then to come up with a realistic range, we go through an exercise where we look at what is your family profile. Again, I mentioned earlier, if you come from a long line of, you know, obese individuals and you've been over, you know, what are the odds that your genetics let you fit into Twiggy's genes? Mm-hmm. So what does your family profile look like? Then what is your personal weight history? And then there's an exercise in the book that you go through that. Again, if you've been overweight your whole life or obese your whole life, odds are of getting into those skinny genes, not great. And here's the thing. If you set unrealistic goal, chances are you may reach it, but you're not going to keep it unless you devote your life to nothing but exercising and not eating, which is not healthy. But more realistically, what happens when the goal is unrealistic is that you get frustrated. It gets harder. You're never getting there. My goodness, I'm working myself to the bone on this. This is so frustrating. And I don't know. Maybe I'll start again next week. Oh, wait, I hear maybe Dr. Phil has a new program I can buy.
Right.
You know,
right.
So that really the foundation starts there with sort of the realistic goal setting. And then the other key thing in that very first step of the very initial chapter is talking about, I call it the 10,000 year question, you know, because I always say, you know, unfortunately, you really mistimed your birth. Our bodies are so beautifully, beautifully built to survive and thrive in an environment that we haven't lived in for like a good 10,000 years, right?
Right.
If we're walking 10, 20 miles every day in search of ripe berry bushes or chasing down bisons or I don't know what we were chasing. I'm not an animal person.
Right.
We're burning a ton of calories, burning a ton of energy, just getting food. Mm-hmm. And the food is unlike today's processed, mostly processed food. It's not especially calorically dense. So think about it. That's what you're built for. That's what your DNA is built for. And here's the other, the sort of the end of that story that I like to go over with patients is in that environment. So, you know, you and I, we're part of this tribe, this psych tribe, and you and I are the chief hunters, and we've been tracking this large protein source for days, and we finally bring the beast down and we schlep them back to camp. And is that the time when they're carving up the hopefully cooked food to share with us for us to say, oh, wait, please. No, I'll just have 3 ounces. Just, you know, I don't want anything bigger than the palm of my hand. Right. oh my gosh, or, you know, just a cup full of berries, because, you know, they're high sugar, and oh my gosh, you won't live to bring down another bison. So it's almost like our DNA has set us up. What does that sound like? I mean, I'm going to eat until it's all gone, and I'm right. probably going to eat kind of quickly to make sure I get my share, so you don't get my share.
Right. Right.
It kind of sounds like binge eating, doesn't it?
It does a little bit, but
yeah. So I go through that whole exercise with the reader, with the objective of starting to kind of forgive yourself a little bit. Right.
Yeah.
It's like,
yes, absolutely.
I know you've worked in the field too, Howard. So I know you've sat there and you know, at an intake, patient has sat there and wept about how they have no willpower and they're so terrible and they don't know why they can't do this and they feel like horrible pigs and all kinds. It's like, cut yourself a break, yourself some slack. I'm doing what my DNA structures me to do. So let's be realistic about that. Let's get off the self-flagellation. Let's stop whipping ourselves. And then say, okay, what can we realistically do to improve our health?
Yeah.
Right. And so from there, we go on and then the subsequent chapters. And from there, we go to motivation, which is really part of the foundation, but is sufficiently important that I give it a devoted chapter. And, you know, some of the stuff is stuff you would expect to hear at Weight Watchers or talking with your friends. But I think one of the things that I have learned over the years is important, is to talk about, or two things in particular that most books and programs don't address. One is talk about the reasons to not do this. What are the reasons, what are the cons to losing weight or even, you know, to getting a healthier weight? What are the advantages of staying exactly the way I am? Because those are the invisible landmines, right? I actually tell the story in the book. I had a patient, this lovely woman, I saw her for quite a while. She actually had, she had come to me, she had gained and lost the same, I don't know, 80, 100 pounds so many times in her life. And she was losing weight again. She went for bariatric surgery, which, you know, does not change your head. It only changes the configuration of your GI tract. And we went on and on, and she just struggled and struggled. She'd start losing weight and then she'd like run back up the weight scale. And what she finally arrived at was just, you know, when I start losing weight, I look more like my mother. Well, her mother was an abusive, crappy mother. She hated her mother. And when she started seeing her mother in the mirror, she started running. So what are the pros and cons? Then the other thing that I focus on in that chapter is, it's great when you're all motivated at the beginning, and so there's strategies for how do you capture some of that motivation for later. But then the final thing we do in that chapter is, how do you keep going when there's no motivation?
Because motivation ebbs and flows like the tide. You're not going to be highly motivated 24 hours a day, every day of the week. It isn't. It comes and goes. Yes, and there's some strategies to try to keep connected with that motivation, but it's still going to ebb and flow. And, you know, there are going to be circumstances where you are highly programmed, and it's highly probable you are going to eat, you know, those cakes, ice creams, whatever, right? And so much of this, and this is why I really appreciate your approach to it, because so much of this is, the talk about it typically is designed, or at least has the effect of making people feel bad about themselves and guilty. That's great. That's nonsense. Oh, look, here's a TV ad. So-and-so lost 100 pounds on this stupid program. God knows how she did it. You know, perhaps she had an operation or something. I don't know. But then the person it doesn't work for is thinking, oh, what a loser I am. Why can't I'm not a loser. Why can't I do that? And then, you know, all the negatives that flow from that. It was just horrendous. And, you know, part of that is to keep the problem alive, you just wonder how much some of these weight loss products have actually made the problem worse, not better, which is, of course, in their interest because that gives them more clients. But a reasonable approach is exactly what you're saying is, why do you want to do this? And can you do this? Let's look at all
and
these
how
facts.
Much of it, how much of it.
Right. Yeah. And you ask pretty much anyone really, certainly a lot of women in this country, they'll tell you how many they've tried everything. I've tried everything. And maybe they have, which means, you know, perhaps they shouldn't be, that goal is unreasonable, you know, a bit like me saying, I've tried everything to be able to fly in the air like Superman and nothing's worked.
Right. Because flying like Superman is not realistic.
Exactly.
And weighing what your best friend weighs or what you weighed in high school when you're now 53, right? I'm not even as tall as I was when I was in high school.
Yeah. And so it's very distressing and disturbing from the perspectives that we both have, looking at it from the practical and science-based research and what is realistic. It's, as H.G. Wells said, you know, probably 70 years ago, he'd definitely say it now, you know, advertising is legalized lying.
Yes.
And unfortunately, a lot of it is, and probably nowhere is it more evident than in the weight loss industry.
Oh,
wouldn't you agree?
Weight loss. Oh, yeah. The weight loss industry, which obviously I am a part of, although I like to think I'm a nice part of it, an honest part
yes,
of it.
Yes, of course.
Which is why I think the first line in the book is, I will never be a millionaire. Right? Because if I wanted to be a millionaire, I would say this is guaranteed. And all you have to do is buy 6 copies of my book. Each of your family members. And right.
Yep.
But and you don't even have to read it. You just have to give me the money and you'll lose weight.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's not true. And so there are realistic objectives and motivational concerns. And then the rest of the book, up until the final chapter, which is a little bit different, addresses the psychological and the psychosocial connections between environment and hunger, emotions and hunger, exercise and hunger, food and hunger, and how what are the behavioral, the external behaviors, right? What are the actions you can take? You know, a lot of the stuff is again Weight Watchers 101. You know, if having a bowl of M&Ms on your desk means you're snacking on M&Ms all day, for heaven's sake.
Right.
Fill the bowl with marbles
Yeah, exactly.
You know, or get rid of the bowl. But then a lot of it is, so there's the external actions, but then there's also the cognitive piece, which is, you know, I think where you and I share so much ground. What are you saying to yourself about this? What's your narrative? Oh, poor me. I can't have M&Ms on my desk. I have no willpower. I don't even deserve to have a healthier body versus, boy, I rock. The M&Ms were a problem. I solved the problem. 10 points for me.
Yep, absolutely.
Right? So, and I'm simplifying it a little, but that's sort of where the book goes. The final chapter is a leftovers chapter. It talks about things that don't necessarily fit in the other chapters, which is will acupuncture make me lose weight? Will hypnosis make me lose weight? Mm-hmm. Will bariatric surgery make me lose weight? And I would like to talk about bariatric surgery too before we're done. So questions like that, but then the one of the questions in there that I'm thinking I might make into a pamphlet that I give out for free is, you know, remember the title of the book is "A Diet is the Last Thing You Need." And sometimes when you get to the end of doing all of these other gentle adjustments, sometimes you do say, you know, I need a structured diet. Well, fine.
guidance. Yeah.
How do you decide what works for you? Right. Which takes me back to one of the key points I make in the food and hunger chapter. I actually just recently put a blog out about that too, is if you're following someone else's diet, it's a finite, it's a task with an end point. I'm going to follow your diet, Howard. I'm going to eat everything you eat until my weight hits X. Then I'm going back to my life because I am not Howard Rankin. I'm Brenda Wolf.
Right.
So,
exactly.
So it's like, how do you, I talk about, you know, whatever dietary strategy you come up with, it has to address nutrition. It has to address flavor, right? I don't like shellfish. You can put me on the lobster diet and I'll lose weight because I'll starve to death because I won't eat it, right? Mm-hmm. Nutrition, flavor preferences, and tradition. Don't tell me, had my mother not died, that I could never eat her potato knishes again. My mom made the best, and chopped liver, which I won't eat anyone else's. But I mean, I'm being a little bit facetious, but the dietary strategy has to fit you.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it's just send me your money and don't worry about it.
Right. Yeah. And again, this is always the problem with generalized advice. And your approach obviously is much more appropriate and realistic, which is you've got to look at the individual. You just got to look at the individual, as you say, their genes, their circumstances, their environment, their history. I mean, all of those things. There's no one size fits all. In pretty much anything, but certainly in this field, right? And just for convenience and making money, we make it sound like, all you need to do is just do this one thing and you'll be fine. You know, that hardly ever works for anything, let alone something as important as eating, right? So, it's unfortunate to say the very, very least, and we need more input like yours, which is don't listen to that. It's more negative, way more negative than it's positive. You can't do that. Even if you were to do it for a short while, it's not sustainable. So so absolutely. And it does change people's perceptions of themselves. It changes their remember for a few years, I was the consultant psychologist for Take Off Pounds Sensibly, or TOPS.
Remember that?
I did like that organization because it's really a non-profit organization, and it isn't giving any particular technique or diet or anything. It's a support group that supports people in their attempts. And, I found the motivation extremely good. I thought the ethics were great. Obviously, the groups themselves varied enormously.
Right.
Some were fantastic. I mean, some of them were unbelievable results.
Yeah.
And some were, it was really more like a moan session, you know, every week. So that's true of any organization that runs groups. But, you know, most of these organizations, it's all about the profit. And this is a field where you can easily dupe people. And again, the side effect of that is some real negative self-perceptions and memories. I remember one time I was talking to this woman at TOPS, and she said, I always thought that I was fat on my wedding day. I always said that. Oh, yeah, you know, 30 years ago, I was so fat. And then she said, just recently, I saw a photo of me and I looked great. I was probably 120 pounds, but she had, you know, she'd been brainwashed.
Well, look at the images of beauty ideals in our culture. And really for the last, not 100 years, maybe the last 50 years. When I train docs and stuff, and I talk about what are the sociocultural pressures, and this is talking about just eating disorders, but it's applicable here. I have this fabulous slide of Sports Illustrated cover, swimsuit cover from, it was like 1965. And then I think the most recent one I have is 2000 something, 18, you know, within the last few years. And that this, the one from the 60s, this girl, I mean, you look at her and you just go, oh, apple pie, mom, I can't wait to introduce. I mean, she just has these rosy cheeks and she's looks like a woman, you know, a young woman, you know. Right. And then the current one, she's like scary. You know, it's like the first one, you can't wait to introduce her to dad. The second one, you don't want dad in the room with her. I mean, she's bony. She's sinewy. She's like, clearly, I hope that woman was Photoshopped some, because if she's truly hard-bodied, she probably has an eating disorder.
Yeah. So. And this whole thing, of course, the advent of social media, I know for many teenage girls and even young adult girls, maybe even older, but specifically that group, that have so much comparison anxiety with what they see of their friends and celebrities and what have you, I think that's fueled an increase in eating disorders, hasn't it? An anorexia of people looking, how can I look like that, you know?
So there are more and more, have been more and more studies coming out over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, linking lots of social media usage. Although the data is a little bit mixed. I'm trying to sort it out in my head a little bit. So there is a longstanding body of literature substantiating the fact that you can manipulate someone's body image fairly easily. Sit you down in a room, have you spend 20 minutes looking at like amazing bodies of, you know, whether you're male or female, gender matched or identity matched individuals, and body image satisfaction pre and post goes from, you know, okay to, oh my God, I suck. Social media exacerbates that. But then there have been a few studies I've seen recently where they said, well, so in some cases, when the people using like the Instagram and I forget what the others are, I am old. Snapchat.
Well, you know, Instagram.
Snapchat. Huh?
Mm-hmm. TikTok.
Yeah, all those. So, you know, when they sort of use them with a close circle of friends that are sort of supportive, then it can be very helpful. But but overall, yes, social media comes up in therapy a lot.
Right? Really? Yeah.
It's like people, the line between real life, real friends, real interactions, and 150 characters or less gets very blurry.
Oh, no question about that. Yeah. And I do some work with Sapiens Labs, and they do multi-country research on mental health, and their recent report across 34 countries was the 18 to 24 year old age group, which grew up with the internet and have known nothing else. That group suffer a lot, and they are like 44% of them are either very stressed or distressed about their social self. Their appearance, how they compare with others, self-blame, self-guilt. Now, clearly there are people who go on and get positive aspects of it. So it's, you know, we're not saying it's all terrible, but clearly there is a substantial potential for negative impact.
Yeah.
Especially when, you know, you can Photoshop anything, right? So, you know, are you really looking at a realistic image of, you know, that woman or that girl, it's not good.
You know, and your point about cohort of people, the ones who grew up with the social media, having more stress, more body image distress and stuff. I mean, if you think about it, so as you were talking about that, I'm like flashing to patient conversations, what's today, Thursday? Yeah, yesterday in clinic, and this brilliant young woman and was invited to this professional thing at work, unexpected, and she didn't go because she hadn't done her hair that day and she had weighed herself and her weight was up, right? And so the conversations that I have and that we talk about some in the book as well, because I do talk about body image, is there's so much more to you than your appearance. I mean, you already heard me make a crack about my height. I used to be 5 feet. I'm 4'11 now. It's like going downhill. What does that have to do with my quality as a clinician? What does that have to do with my quality as a wife, as a mother, as a sister, as a friend, right? And when that social comparison is happening in 150 characters or in a Snapchat or a TikTok, you don't get that subtext, right? So
right, absolutely.
When I look at you and I go, oh, I'm not as good looking as he is, but I'm holding my own in the conversation, right? There's more input,
right?
Right, there are more variables.
Yeah,
that are protective.
Interestingly enough, there is research which shows that a virtual interaction is nothing like a real interaction.
Right.
That the mirror neuron system that, you know, it promotes empathy and understanding and interpretation of what's going on, if it works at all, it's very minimal in virtual interaction. And so if you're spending 7-8 hours in virtual interaction, that means you're not spending very much time in real life interaction.
Right.
And so the Sapiens researchers sort of calculate that an 18-year-old today, in terms of exposure to real life interaction, is probably the equivalent of a 10-year-old in social and emotional skills, 30 pre-internet times, because so much of their time has been spent in virtual, really doesn't teach you anything, as opposed to social. And that's a problem. It's a big problem because it's only going to get worse.
That is a very big problem. That makes me so sad. Think about the state of the world today and the 24/7 news cycle and the rapidity with which information, misinformation, disinformation, is transmitted and retransmitted and on and on and on and on and on. The potential for, I know I'm sounding a little bit dramatic here, but the potential for apocalypse, whether it be apocalyptic with respect to, you know, my little corner of the psych world, which is how people feel about their bodies, or apocalyptic with respect to transmission of deadly diseases or people pushing red buttons to nuclear. Oh, gosh.
I think we're going
a little far afield here.
Well, we can bring it back to individuals, too. I mean, I think the general feeling is, despite, you know, advancement in some ways, you know, perhaps humanity or civilization, which really hasn't been going that long in the grand scheme of things, is just becoming more alienated, more polarized, you know, abandoned truth. We don't care about science. It's I believe what I want to believe. All of that is so, so devastating to society and individuals. There's an interesting guy called James Wheel. He has a great YouTube video. He wrote a book called Recapture the Rapture. And he goes in, it's a short video, it's like 7 minutes, but it's really excellent. It talks about the major problems that we face, things we've been talking about the last few minutes. Yeah. And it's scary. It's scary. And so definitely, and honestly, I do think that the whole weight loss thing, which is a reflection of social self and so forth, is actually a very good reflection of the problems that we face, you know?
Yeah.
Very simple-minded view of it, totally avoids, you know, totally discards, apart from people like yourself, discards really sensible, critical, realistic variables, like how much can you really lose, is run by a few people geared to profit rather than helping people for the most part.
Right.
And the weight loss industry is a good example of that. And you can find examples of that pretty much everywhere you look.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Wow. What does that say to us as individuals? What does that mean for us as societies, as a civilization, as individuals? You know, no wonder there's so much trauma and stress amongst people, you know. What's their meaning and purpose? What's their contribution? How do we define ourselves? Most people define themselves maybe by their occupation, but that's very limited. So, yeah, really interesting. James, will you recapture?
Yeah, I wrote it down.
Yeah, good. Yeah, excellent. Recapture the rapture. So you listeners out there should go watch that, because it's very thought-provoking. Okay, so as we come towards the end here, before we get to how people can reach you and find your book and all of that, how would you summarize your, I know it's well represented in the book, but how would you summarize, if you're talking to somebody, a listener here who's, you know, concerned about their weight, let's say legitimately concerned about their weight, you know, what would you say to them?
Carefully consider what your current situation, condition is, and what you think it should be. Make sure that your plan or your target makes sense. And as I do say in the book somewhere, you know, so when you make the decision, I'm going to make some changes to take better care of my body. Count that today is day one of your journey, and then stop counting, because the journey is the destination. So if you decide that, yes, you know, I'm not doing right by my body, that's where you start. More important than even figuring out your target, because the target's kind of a, trying to think of a good way to frame it. You know, you have the difference between nice to have and need to have. The target's a kind of, I like to have, but it might not really be good for me to have anyhow.
Yeah.
It's a two-sided coin. Focus on making the kinds of behavioral changes that I talk about in my book. And then I have that blog site, and I have, in addition to blogs, there's like information on basic behaviors and stuff. Narrowing the stimulus field, like, so start to shape, make small behavioral changes to make it easier for you to make good food choices. Yeah. You know, and nobody likes to hear this, so I will be the bearer of repeated bad news, is you got to increase your activity. You know, you can't, I mean, you could just like not eat enough to maintain your body weight and you will lose weight. But in the process of doing that, if you're not also moving, you're doing some irreparable harm, and you're also interfering with the efficiency of whatever it is you're doing dietarily. So you need to eat a little bit less, not a lot, a little bit. You need to move a little bit more. You know, with respect to exercise, I always tell patients, start where you are. Yep. You cannot start a 10K run at the finish line. And that's a metaphor. You don't have to do 10K runs. Right. If you've been sitting on the sofa for the last year, 20 years, then your exercise assignment is to stand up during every television commercial this week. Mm-hmm. And when that gets easy, walk around the sofa. Right.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, you'd be stunned if you watch a football game, for example. If you just walked during the commercials, you'd be stunned how many miles you would walk.
But Howard, those are the only interesting parts of a football game.
Oh, well, that's true. Okay, yeah, that's true. I think one of the things...
I'm Canadian. It's hockey, Howard. It's hockey.
Oh, I'm sorry, hockey. Yeah, yeah. Good game last night in Stanley Cup Finals. I think I want to add a couple of things. One is small changes can make a big difference. So that's really important.
And small changes are the only ones that make a lasting difference.
That's right. And then the other thing is focus on the process, not the product, right? Focus on the process of making yourself healthy or making these changes, small changes at a time, rather than, oh, I got to be 148 pounds, you know, by the time we go to so-and-so's wedding. Forget that. Forget that. That's the wrong focus. The focus is here and now. Here and now. Right now, what am I doing? And that's okay. And to feel good about that, that would change your whole mindset, I think, to, oh, this is a burden. I can't possibly do it. I'm being made to do it. To, hey, I'm doing this. I feel good about it. I feel I've got some control over it. That's great. That's where you need to be, on the process, not the end point.
The journey is the destination. The process is the destination.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we could go on and probably will. But in terms of how people can reach you or where they can find your blogs, I will put that in the notes, but just let us know.
Okay. So the book, A Diet is the Last Thing You Need, Weight Loss and Maintenance Answers, is available in both in both paperback and Kindle on Amazon. I have a website called Brenda L. Wolfe, all one word, .com. You can also get to that website by typing get a handle on your habits, all one word, but it's more typing. But if you like to type, you could go that way. They go to the same place. And on that website, you will find more blah, blah, blah about me. Recommendations, there's a page I call Goodreads and Resources, which obviously lists my books, but also includes other books that I recommend to address eating disorders, obesity, anxiety, depression, other challenges. Your book, Howard, your latest book, is on that page as well. Also included in that website are sections about eating disorders, pages about eating disorders, page about obesity, and then blogs. I blog. My target is 2 blogs a month. Sometimes it's 3 or 4. Sometimes it's like, oh, Brenda was busy this month. But the blogs cover topics that sort of span obesity and eating disorders, as well as some general self-care stuff.
Yeah.
So, and then there's an author page on Amazon that you could follow.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you for your time today. Thank you for all you have done over the course of your career. I'm sure you've helped many, many, many people. I personally know it's a wonderful feeling when you get good feedback from somebody who said, you won't remember, but I saw you 20 years ago and I can't tell you how a difference you made. I'm sure there's lots of people who could say
that.
So we appreciate that. I'm glad you failed at retirement, because I think
it's a hard job to quit.
Well, yes, it is. But retirement is a dumb idea anyway. I mean, why define a really critical part of your life where you have a lot of expertise? Why define that by something you're not doing, going to a regular job? It doesn't make sense. So we have to change that. Some people have suggested rewirement. You know, you manifest it in different ways, which I think is better. But so I'm glad you failed at it.
Thank you.
Okay, well, awesome. Thank you again so much, Brenda. It's always great to see you, and continue the great work. And hopefully, listeners, you will get a copy of Brenda's book, read her blogs, and get some inspiring and practical advice about your weight.
Thank you very much. This has been great fun.
Yeah. Okay. Till the next time, take care.